Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are digging into a really fascinating area using a key source, Virginia Berridge's Big Historical Analysis, Public Health. And we're tackling a topic you probably think you basically understand already.
Yeah, and that's exactly the trap, isn't it? Most people think of public health history as this sort of straight line upwards. You know, scientists discover something, everyone adopts it, disease vanishes. Simple. Progress.
But Berridge basically says, hold on, that's way too simple. Almost a comforting myth. So our mission in this deep dive is to figure out why public health has always been so political, so debated. I mean, think about it, from huge 19th century sewer projects dictating how cities were built.
Right.
All the way to, you know, today's arguments about vaccine mandates or sugar taxes or masks.
Yeah.
It's never just been about the science.
Absolutely. And Berridge gives us this fantastic critical toolkit. The goal here is to help you use it. Because once you see public health as being just as much about power, values, and money as it is about germs, well, suddenly current debates make a lot more sense.
They stop looking like purely technical arguments.
Exactly. They become visible as what they often are. Ideological battles about power and responsibility, who gets to decide and who has to change.
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this viewpoint, Virginia Berridge. A major figure, especially in the UK context, right?
Definitely. A really distinguished historian. And what makes her perspective so powerful is her position. She's a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So she's right inside the public health world.
Okay.
But, and this is the key thing, her background, her training is in history, not medicine, not public health practice itself.
Ah, so she has that critical distance. She's not just there to sort of cheerlead for the profession.
Precisely. She's not writing a celebratory history. She's digging into the foundations, the assumptions, the claims to authority. It's that crucial outsider's view from within the system.
Makes sense.
And she's particularly known for her work on really controversial stuff, lifestyle issues, smoking, alcohol, drugs. She traces how the evidence, public panic, and commercial interests all get tangled up.
So she shows how something that starts as just a personal choice,
yeah,
gets reframed, redefined by powerful groups as a public health crisis that needs state action. It's all about how risk gets defined, really.
That's a perfect summary of her approach. And if you boil down her central argument, it's this. Public health isn't some fixed scientific truth. It's fundamentally a social and political construct.
What do you mean?
Meaning what counts as a public health priority,
right.
How we define health itself, who gets targeted for intervention.
Ah.
All of that changes. It reflects the power dynamics and the dominant ideas of any given era.
Wow. Okay. That's a big reframing. So things like obesity or addiction,
yeah,
they aren't inherently public health problems until someone makes them so.
Pretty much. Until influential players, governments, scientists, maybe even corporations successfully frame them that way, justifying certain actions. And her book takes us on this incredible journey through time to show how this happens.
Where does it start?
It kicks off in the 19th century. Think Industrial Revolution, booming cities, lots of filth and chaos. Berridge calls this the old public health, and it was all about the environment.
The physical surrounding.
Exactly. The big fear then wasn't germs, not yet. It was miasma, this idea that disease came from foul air, bad smells rising from sewage and decay.
So the answer was engineering.
Massive engineering projects, centralized state action, building huge sewer networks, ensuring clean water, clearing slums. The idea was you fix the environment around people, which of course meant the state getting heavily involved in private property and lives.
But then science marches on.
Right. The 1880s bring the bacteriological revolution. Pasteur, cross-germ theory. Suddenly you have a specific enemy, the microbe.
The magic bullet idea. Find the germ, make a vaccine or drug.
Exactly. A huge scientific leap. But then, fast forward past World War II, infectious diseases are mostly under control in wealthy countries, and the focus shifts dramatically.
To chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer.
Yes. The diseases of longer lifespans. This is where Berridge introduces what she calls the new public health, and it's driven by a completely different idea.
Which is?
The lifestyle drift. The enemy isn't outside anymore, like dirty water. It's inside. It's individual behavior. Smoking, what you eat, whether you exercise.
Ah, so the responsibility shifts massively from the state cleaning up the environment to the individual managing their own body.
You got it. And that puts the burden squarely on the citizen. which leads directly to all the modern political fights about the nanny state versus personal freedom.
Okay, let's go a bit deeper into that history. The old public health, you said it involved massive state intervention. What justified that philosophically?
Utilitarianism, mainly.
Yeah.
The whole greatest good for the greatest number idea. That was the perfect ethical framework for overriding individual rights.
How so?
Well, if your private slum property or your overflowing cesspit was seen as a threat to the whole city's health and economic productivity,
then the state could argue it had the right, even the duty, to step in, force you to connect to the new sewer system, for instance.
Precisely. Individual liberty took a back seat to collective well-being and, frankly, social order. And the key figure pushing this was Edwin Chadwick. Interestingly, he wasn't a doctor. He was a lawyer, a social reformer.
A manager, essentially.
Absolutely. His approach was about efficiency, central control over sanitation. It wasn't driven by empathy so much as by a desire for order and productivity.
Okay, but then comes the germ theory. Huge scientific win. But you mentioned a downside.
Yes, Berridge points out something subtle but important. Identifying specific germs, while brilliant science, also kind of narrowed the focus politically.
I mean,
well, if you can pinpoint the cholera bacterium, it becomes easier for governments to focus on vaccines, maybe quarantine, and potentially shift away from tackling the more complex, expensive social conditions that made people vulnerable in the first place.
Like poverty, terrible housing.
Exactly. It offered an intellectual pathway, if you like, to move responsibility away from fixing the environment and towards managing the germ and increasingly the individual's interaction with it, like hygiene.
And this trend continued into the 20th century.
To some extent, yes. When you get big welfare states like Britain's NHS, public health sometimes got a bit overshadowed by the focus on curative medicine. Hospitals, treatments, prevention took a bit of a backseat.
But there were countercurrents.
Oh, yes. Berridge highlights the importance of social medicine. This was a movement that kept insisting on the links between sickness and society, poverty, housing, inequality. They argued these were the root causes, even if hospital medicine was grabbing the headlines and the funding.
Okay, so that sets the stage for the big post-war shift. The new public health, driven by epidemiology, you said.
Yes, the science of populations and statistics, particularly the identification of risk factors. This is where the lifestyle drift really takes hold.
Because the enemy isn't one single germ anymore.
Right. It's a whole web of interconnected factors, many of them behavioral. Your diet, whether you smoke, how much you drink, if you exercise. The focus moves from engineering sewers to, as Berridge puts it, trying to engineer behavior.
And the smoking example really shows this.
It's a perfect case study. Smoking went from being seen as, you know, a sophisticated personal choice.
Right. Very Mad Men era.
Exactly. To being statistically linked to lung cancer by major studies like the British Doctor study. Suddenly, epidemiology reconstructed it. It wasn't just a personal choice anymore. It was a public health enemy.
Which then justified the state stepping in more and more. Bans, high taxes, warning labels.
All framed as necessary collective action against a newly defined public threat. It shows how data can redefine the boundaries of personal freedom.
Now, what about HIV/AIDS in the 80s? That seems like a really pivotal moment, too.
Hugely important. Berridge uses it to show just how non-medical a public health response can be. The initial reaction wasn't just about a virus. It was tangled up with fear, moral judgment, intense stigma, particularly aimed at gay men, the so-called risk groups.
So a purely top-down, coercive approach wouldn't work.
It would have been disastrous. It actually forced public health to shift gears, to adopt what's called a health promotion model. That meant working with affected communities, with activists.
Like harm reduction groups.
Exactly. Needle exchanges, safe sex education developed with the community. It hammered home the lesson that you have to understand social dynamics, culture, individual rights. You can't just issue dictates from on high, especially when dealing with stigma and behavior.
Which brings us to today, contemporary challenges. These issues are global now, aren't they?
Completely. Pandemics obviously showed us that, but also chronic issues. Berridge talks about globesity, the global rise in obesity and related diseases like diabetes.
And does her framework apply there too?
Perfectly. You see the same historical patterns. Public health bodies point to the data, suggest things like sugar taxes or restrictions on junk food marketing.
And immediately run into massive opposition.
From huge global food and beverage companies, they lobby hard, they shape the narrative, often pushing their responsibility firmly back onto the individual consumer. It's about personal choice. even while they engineer environments that make unhealthy choices the easiest ones, especially in poorer communities or developing countries, the tension is exactly the same.
Okay, so pulling this all together, what are the core messages, the main lenses Berridges gives us to look at public health?
I think the absolute most fundamental one is about the shifting definition of the public and health. Just think about that journey. The public starts as this passive object that the state needs to manage environmentally clean its surroundings.
Like tidying up a messy room.
Kind of. But by the late 20th century, the public becomes this collection of individuals, each with their own risk profile that needs to be assessed and modified. The state's focus shifts from the environment to the person.
And that changes everything about the relationship between the state and the citizen, which leads to the second big theme.
The enduring tension between individual liberty and collective good. This is the fault line that runs right through the entire history. From Chadwick forcing people to connect to sewers, to debates today about vaccine mandates or smoking bans.
It's always a negotiation.
Always. It's political. There's no purely scientific answer for where to draw that line. It gets redrawn constantly, depending on how bad the perceived threat is and whose values are dominant.
And the third key theme connects back to that shift you mentioned earlier.
Yes. The contest between environmental and individualist models. Berridge charts this huge swing from blaming the environment, the structures.
Bad drains.
Right. To blaming the individual's choices.
The smoking, the diet.
Exactly. And her warning is that relying too heavily on that individual model, while maybe politically easier sometimes, risks just becoming victim blaming.
Because it ignores all the background factors. Poverty, lack of access, marketing.
All the deep structural constraints that shape people's choices way more powerfully than any health leaflet ever could. It lets the system off the hook.
Berridge captures these ideas in some really punchy ways, doesn't she? Not just dry history.
Absolutely. They're like little analytical takeaways. For instance, challenging that simple progress story, she basically says, public health history is not a triumphant march of progress, but a winding path shaped by political negotiation, economic interest, and social anxiety.
That really captures the messiness, the human element.
It does. And then there's the core shift. The focus of public health has dramatically shifted from the environment that surrounds the person to the person within the environment. We move from engineering sewers to engineering behavior. That phrase, engineering behavior, really sticks.
Yeah, it does. It's quite stark.
And finally, underlining the politics. Every public health intervention is inherently political, a negotiation between the rights of the individual and the responsibilities of the state. It reminds us that these debates are fundamentally about values, not just data.
So bringing this back to the listener, how can we actually use this historical perspective day to day?
Well, first, it gives you tools for critical consumption of health news. When you hear about the next health scare or some new policy proposal,
you can ask different questions.
Exactly. Ask, who's framing this as a crisis and why? Are there commercial interests involved? Drug companies, food companies? Is focusing on individual behavior letting bigger structural issues off the hook? Like, why are healthy options unaffordable or unavailable in some areas?
It helps you see behind the headlines and for engaging with policy.
It allows for much more informed citizenship and policy analysis. Think about things like sugar taxes or lockdowns or mental health initiatives. Berridge's history gives you context. Is this a reasonable measure for collective safety? Or is it an overreach? Is it likely to be effective given the social constraints people face? It lets you have a more nuanced discussion beyond just gut reactions.
And there's a personal angle too, isn't there, about personal health and guilt?
Yeah, I think this is really important. If you struggle with lifestyle choices, feeling guilty about diet or exercise, this history helps you see it's not just about willpower.
It shows the bigger picture.
Right. It reveals these huge commercial and social forces actively shaping your environment, pushing unhealthy options, making healthy choices harder. It doesn't remove personal responsibility entirely, of course, but it denaturalizes some of that guilt. It encourages a more critical look at the world around you, not just yourself.
So, final thoughts. What's the biggest takeaway for you from Berridge's work?
For me, it's that unresolved tension, constant back and forth between focusing on the individual's choices and focusing on the environmental or structural factors that shape those choices. That's the central challenge, and it's not going away. We just have to keep debating, keep negotiating where that balance lies.
Yeah, that really resonates. And for me, I think it's the simple, powerful idea that context is everything. Public health isn't this clean, objective science operating in a vacuum. It's messy, it's human, it's deeply political. Every statistic, every policy, has a history and a set of values embedded within it. Realizing that changes how you see health debates entirely. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.